And welcome everyone to another episode of All Things Trek. I'm Oren.
I am David.
No Grace today, unfortunately, but we do have two very special guests. First, I would like to introduce the Trekkie feminist, Jara Hodge.
Hello.
And Bob.
Yo. But not like brick to head special, mind you, just special as in we're cool people.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, the good kind. Jara, since there's a couple of people who may not have been around for the last time you were on the show, why don't you remind everybody who you are and what you do?
Sure. My totally unpaid gigs is that I run a Tumblr called Trekkie Feminist at trekkiefeminist.tumblr.com. Through that, met you guys at Star Trek Las Vegas and have also done some other sort of convention commenting on sort of Star Trek and gender issues.
And you write at Feminist Frequency too, don't you?
No, is Anita Sarkeesian, who is a friend of mine, but I don't write for her. I also have a blog called Gender Focus, which is gender-focus.com.
Right, okay. See, that'll teach me to not be absolutely sure I know which feminist blog I'm talking about when I start a show.
No worries.
And for those of you who are newer to the show, Bob is one of our co-hosts from Days of Yore. If you bust out your archaeologist like brushes, you can probably find him in the fossil record somewhere.
Ooh, you wound me, sir.
I may have just called you old. I'm not sure. Maybe I was calling the show old. Who knows?
That's a good point. How old is this show now? Is it 3 years? Coming up on 3 years?
Coming
Four?
Up on 3 years. We're going to be at episode 150 soon.
When do we start this shindig?
I don't know. I could look it up, but I'm not going to. It's about three years ago. All right. So I have one piece of administrational stuff to do before we get onto the show itself, which is that a good friend of our show, a listener who goes by Lanny, has a GoFundMe page for her transition that she's working on, and I'm going to put the link to that in the chat room and in the show notes. And she's really cool, and she deserves some of our help. So if you're up for it, I would go there and check it out. All right. That part of the show is now finished. It is now time for the main topic. No, wait, no. No, it's not. There's one more thing. I forgot. I'm the worst of this. So, guys, I just recently saw what I thought I had seen every episode of Star Trek, and I saw one that I had not seen. It was really weird. Nobody asked me what it was. I'm just going to sit here.
Well,
being
I already
like,
know what it was from Facebook, but...
I'm just waiting for you to get on with it so I can make snarky comments.
Guys, you have to maintain the polite fiction that we haven't already talked about this before.
Oh, crumbs. What was it, Oren?
Star Trek the Animated Series?
He's clearly seen that, because I know we've had discussions about Phaser Defense Ball already.
You gotta love the Phaser Defense Ball. No, I have already seen Star Trek the Animated Series. It was Bliss, the Voyager Season 5 episode. Which, for anyone who doesn't remember, is the episode where they run into a giant space monster that eats starships and is also a mind control creature, which was an interesting, you know, an interesting combination of tropes right there. And it makes everyone think that they're going to go into a wormhole to go home, which, if this was season 2, would just be the plot of the episode. But, you know, this is season 5, so a little more jaded by now. So it turns out that's mind control, and Seven of Nine's not affected because she has Borg implants, and Naomi Wildman isn't affected because Seven needs someone to talk to. And they have, you know, their adventures, and they go inside of it, and then they escape.
So far, this has sounded like a normal Voyager day. What's so weird about this?
Well, the episode's not particularly weird. What was weird is that this is the one episode of Star Trek that I had never seen. Like, I thought I saw all of them, and somehow I missed this one.
Yeah, I had to rewatch it because I couldn't really remember it very well. And I felt like they could have spent longer before we know that they're wrong about the wormhole. Like, you basically know right off the bat that something's weird with the crew. And there was almost, I feel like, too much time spent with the, trying to fix things to get out of the problem instead of having any sort of suspense built up about getting into the problem.
Yeah, you could definitely hear the crew rolling their eyes at the beginning when they first find the wormhole. It's like,
yeah, and it just
wait,
made everyone look kind of stupid because they don't actually ever say it's because of Seven's implants. They sort of imply that it's because her and Naomi can't share the delusion because they don't want to go home. But then when she tries to reason with Tuvok, and Tuvok like just really wants to see his wife and Janeway's like changed her log 3 times in the last 3 days and just like went from being totally suspicious to being totally like she's totally bought this. I don't know, it just makes them kind of like all look dumb.
Yeah, I was actually sort of disappointed that they didn't do more with the rest of the crew. Like, it really felt like Tuvok would have had the mental discipline to see past it.
Totally.
And as much as I hate Neelix, this was actually a natural episode for Neelix, because, like, Neelix doesn't have anything invested in going to Earth. Like, he actually, you know, spoilers for anyone who hasn't seen all of Voyager, he doesn't. He, like, leaves the ship, like, 2 episodes before they get home.
Thank God.
Yeah, which, I mean, it's not like it was a big loss, but, like, if this was, you know, going to be their premise, then they could have at least done something with Neelix, I don't know. But this episode, the other thing about this episode that really annoyed me is, so they
you
have
know,
their...
I'm pretty confident that every time you say something bad about Neelix, Ethan Phillips loses a year off his life.
I got nothing against Ethan Phillips, okay? Ethan
Maybe
Phillips...
Maybe Orin loses a year off his life.
I'm confident this is a universal constant that is a thing.
Like, I think that, you know, Neelix is a terrible character, obviously, but I mean, Ethan Phillips is a fine actor. I think he was just doing what they told him to do, and he couldn't change the script, right? He had to read the lines he was given. But the thing that really weirded me out specifically about this episode was that at the end, They have the option to kill the space monster. They're like, you know, we could kill the space monster, but instead they don't, and they just kind of leave. And it's like, but that thing is going to kill, like, more people. Like, that's what it does. It flies around eating spaceships. Like, don't you guys
kind of have...
That sounds
like a them problem.
I guess.
I didn't have a problem with it, actually. I think that there were a couple extenuating factors. I mean, one, they tried to argue, which I think is reasonable, that, like, this is a life form, we shouldn't kill it before we understand it, and then they had to get the hell out of there. They didn't have time to learn about it and figure out if there was, like, a nice way of getting it to stop eating people. And there's... You know, they say, well, there's no evidence of sentience, but then the alien says, well, you know, clearly he's, like, good enough to trick you into imagining all these different things, and he knows exactly what you want, so it seems like he's probably intelligent. So I think it made sense to me, but I don't know, they could have put up some, like, warning buoys or something around to, like, try and warn other ships.
Well, they did have, like, a throwaway line at the end where they said they put out some beacons, but, like, this thing moves around. Like, it doesn't stay in one place. You know, it just kind of... And it also is mind controls you, so I don't imagine the warning beacons would be that much help. It's like, hey, there's a warning beacon. The warning beacon is saying, go to the alien monster. It will give you presents. Because, I mean, like, I can understand not wanting to kill it, right? I mean, because... Like, there are way it reminds me of the crystalline entity, right? Like, it's not too different from the crystalline entity. It's this giant space life form, which is incredibly destructive, but, you know, maybe there's a way to deal with it without killing it, right? Like, that was their goal for the crystalline entity. But in the case of the crystalline entity, they were devoted to that goal. It was like, hey, we are going to talk to this thing, and we'll destroy it if we have to, because we can't just let it keep running around eating planets. But with this thing, it was kind of like, I guess not our problem. Just, you know, wash our hands of it and keep going. Which I guess
grizzled, grumpy pants alien Ahab was still after it, so maybe he ended up getting it.
I mean,
alien, grumpy, grizzled pants alien. I need that. I need that written down. Hang on.
I'm sure I can isolate it for you.
I think I said grumpy pants.
There's a screen name in there somewhere, I'm sure.
But, like, and that's another thing, is that, like, this is supposed to be, like, an Ahab metaphor, I guess, but, like, Ahab is mad at a whale that, like, took his leg because he was trying to kill it. Like, you know, Moby Dick, the white whale, isn't, like, a dangerous, marauding beast that goes around, like, murdering people. It just is a whale that didn't like being speared. But this thing is not just defending itself. Like, this thing goes around and just devours starships full of civilians and small, tiny, tragic, probably soot-stained faced children.
Yeah, I felt like he was more the Dog the Bounty Hunter of Voyager than the Ahab. It was probably wow. The hair, though.
That's two things I never thought I would imagine together, but wow. I don't remember this episode. I don't think I've ever seen it because I did skip out on parts of Voyager and Enterprise. I need to go back and watch them now. I'm interested in this kind of.
I mean, I guess because of Voyager's format, they were kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place because they didn't want to be like, we're just going to kill this thing because we don't understand it, but we also can't do a continuing story, so we just have to leave at the end of the episode. I don't know, it kind of bugged me. Like, I'm just imagining how many other people this thing is going to kill, and that kind of is on Voyager's head now because they had the option to stop it and they didn't.
There are very, very few instances where the crew of any Star Trek series has actually run into something, a phenomena out in space, and it is actually truly malicious. You know, at least not knowingly malicious. You know, it's always, you know, I think the best to give that entity the benefit of the doubt. So, you know, there was, how'd you say, Jara? Grumpy Grizzled Pants Ahab.
Yeah, Grizzled Grumpy Pants Ahab.
Grizzled Grumpy Pants Ahab, you know, I think he had some sort of story about how his wife and kids or something like that were killed by this thing. Or there was some reason he was hunting it, and it was very personal to him. And he has, in his mind, it's like, well, here's the things that it's doing, so it must be sentient, it must be this evil thing, and then I've got to figure out how to kill it, you know. But, and you even illustrated this already with the crystalline entity, that it's, you know, it's just feeding is all it's doing, you know. It's, you know, while we saw in the episode, yeah, there were a lot of very particular things that were coming up in the crew's minds about, oh yeah, we're going to get home, or it's going to be great, Tuvok's going to see his wife, and, you know, Harry Kim's going to get his promotion finally, you know, all that stuff's going to happen, and it's going to be great, you know. But that might be just a reaction to a electrochemical process that's just being stimulated by whatever the creature has going on. That's all it is. The creature itself isn't implanting the memory and they're going, yeah, guys, ooh, dance my puppets. It's not like it's that. I would think that it's more of a, you know, a luring mechanism is all it is that it's triggering in, you know, the prey that, yeah, so if I do this thing, I'll get to eat today. It's not like, yeah, I'm going to totally just like mind twerk these people and yeah, and then I'll get to eat. You know, I don't think that's the thought process that was going on.
Yeah, but I mean, it's hard to talk about this in terms of like an Earth situation because we don't really have anything like that. But let's just imagine, for instance, if we can, that you had some kind of large Earth predator that was like a, I don't know, like a tiger or maybe an angry rhino, who knows. What I meant specifically was that, like, so imagine if you had a predator running around on Earth that was just like killing, like wiping out like whole towns, you know, has racked up this huge body count. And like at this point, it doesn't really matter if it's intelligent. It might be intelligent, it might not be, but it is definitely going to keep killing people. And like, don't you have a responsibility if you can to stop it? Like, I don't know. It seems like maybe.
I think that you have a responsibility to look out for your self-interest, I think is what it is in the great tradition of the food chain. I think is what it is, you know, so I think it's unfair to brand it as evil. I think it is fair to say this thing wants me dead for nourishment. I don't want to be nourishment.
Did they ever bring up, and I'm probably guessing no, but did they ever bring up the prime directive, the metaphor of like this is a giant whale that just swims through schools of like little fish and so sad for those little fish, but the whale's got to eat. We don't want to be the little fish. We're just going to get at it. But you know what I mean? Like, if you're going to go with that metaphor of the giant whale eating the little fish, it's not evil. It's not menacing. It's just eating. But did they ever say, like, we shouldn't interfere with it? Or did they just never, they just left and then didn't say anything about, oh, too bad for the people after us?
I think the little fish were just glad to get away. I think that's where that left off.
Yeah,
that would have been a good idea. No, all they say is the doctor gets in a fight with the alien dude, the doctor says, like, I'm a doctor, not a dragon slayer. My program requires that I do no harm. And he says something else about, like, we're Starfleet. We're not in the habit of killing life forms.
Yeah, which is, I mean, except for all the ones that Voyager has killed. I mean, you know, they... Like, I mean, does anyone remember Scorpion? I mean, we were just there.
If the doctor was in charge, probably less of them would have died.
That's probably true. I suppose. I don't know. I mean, is the doctor going to get upset at having to like remove a, I don't know, having to remove of like some sort of bacterial infection? Because that's technically a life form. I don't know. It seemed like an oversimplistic way of saying it. It was just like, we're not going to kill this thing, and that will work out great. That it feels like it'd be cold comfort for the next, you know, cruise ship full of people that it eats.
Yeah, no, I see that. I also think, so even though I overall don't have a really big problem with it, I do think it doesn't really make a lot of sense for Seven to take that approach. Like, the doctor makes more sense to me, but I don't see, like, Seven as having developed, like, that much of a commitment to, you know, preserving dangerous life at all costs.
Yeah, that's fair, too. All right, enough about this episode that I'm only interested in because I just saw it and had never seen it before.
But hold on, my question though is, the whole thing was Seven wasn't affected by the mind craziness because of her implants, but what was their explanation for why Naomi wasn't affected? Was that implants or was there some other alien thing? I forget, what was that deal all about?
Jarrah actually already said this pretty well, is that they didn't actually specifically say that Seven was immune because of her implants. I just filled that in because their explanation didn't make any sense. Their explanation is that the reason why Seven and Naomi were immune was that they didn't share everyone else's desire to get back home.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Which, I mean, again, raises the question of why Neelix was affected. So I just assumed that part of the reason that Seven wasn't affected was because her brain is partially synthetic. Like,
Neil just doesn't want to be unpopular. He wants to be with the cool crowd. That's all.
But then she is affected at the end of the episode when the thing tricks her into thinking that they're getting out. The alien, the monster. So I know it's not a super satisfactory explanation that they give.
And it is, and she is affected a little bit, you're right, but she's still shown to be resistant to it. Like, the doctor can talk her out of it and make her, you know, like, it's really, it's less that her reasoning is being affected and more that she's being given false sensory information. Like, you know, she's seeing that they've gotten out, but the doctor explains that doesn't make sense. Like, Seven, just think about it logically, there's no way we could have gotten out yet. So that didn't work on Tuvok for some reason. And the only thing that I could think of that would separate them is that Seven has these, you know, implants.
Yeah, fair enough. I know we don't want to belabor the episode, but it also doesn't make sense that they start receiving the imaginary letters from home, and she supposedly receives a letter from her aunt that's obviously fake. And if the alien is creating these fake images, then why does she see that but still understands everything else is wrong?
Maybe the alien in its spare time is also a columnist. I mean, you know, we'll never know. Yeah, that is a question that I was wondering. I was like, are those real letters? Like, did Neelix write those letters? Is that part of his mind? You know, maybe he just had them, like, prepared. It was like, he was saving them up for a really good prank, and then the creature was, like, mind-controlling him into sending them. I would have been interested to see if she looked at the pads that they had, like, would they be blank? I don't know.
Oh, I also really didn't like the fact that, like, Janeway's thing that she most wanted on coming home was that, like, Mark would have broken off his other engagement. Oh, really? She would just be happy enough about getting home.
I had honestly forgotten who Mark was. Like, I had to, I was like, wait, Mark, who? Oh, right, she was engaged at the beginning. Like, they mentioned that a total of, like, 3 times in the series. Okay, all right. So, this actually doesn't segue too badly into our main topic for today, which is the children of Star Trek, which is to say, primarily the reoccurring children, because this episode very heavily features Naomi Wildman.
I'm not sure I see where the segue is. You went from mind-twisting, starship-eating alien to children. I'm not sure where...
Is that not how you see all children? I mean, come on, Bob. What? But I mean,
well,
specifically...
you know, maybe I have a better, you know, more optimistic worldview than you do. I, you know, doing a word search, you do have the word hate in the notes 4 times.
Do I? Oh, well, that tells you a little something about me. But, well,
but
the reason
there was
I...
a there was a kid in the episode, so that's a good segue, right?
Well, right. That was my segue. Was that this is a Naomi Wildman episode? It's
not just a kid who helps save the ship.
Ooh, yes. There you go.
She provides moral support. She's like, Seven, you can't, you know, be mind controlled. I am way too adorable. And Seven is like, okay, that makes sense.
I'm seeing your guests being your crutch here, Oren.
Say what?
Just carry on.
All right. So, I think that since, like, we're sort of limiting this conversation to characters who appeared in more than one episode, that means we can skip the brilliant episode of The Children Shall Lead, which is something that Bob and I talked about, like, more than a year ago now. I looked it up. That's our episode about children.
Are we going to skip Rascals?
We might talk about Rascals, but I'm primarily interested in the child characters, not really the episode where they all turn into children.
Okay.
I like how you have written here that these are the kind of the big three, but you have four.
I think I actually have five. I just forgot to mention some of them in my notes.
You math so good.
Look, my show notes are a work of art rather than a work of science. What do you want from them? They are not a precise medium. But obviously, the first one that comes to mind when you think of kids in Star Trek is probably going to be Wesley Crusher.
Yeah, basically.
Played by Will Wheaton, who is a cool dude, and if you haven't, I would recommend checking out his audiobook reading of Red Shirts by John Scalzi. It's very good.
I have not read it, but I definitely also enjoy his reviews of Next Generation episodes.
Yeah, those are really good. He hasn't done one for a long time,
though.
I want
at least, like, Volume 1, and then Volume 2 never happened.
I want him to do more of those. But Wesley Crusher is obviously, you know, well-known for being told to shut up in one episode by Star Trek, by Captain Picard. And he's probably the most hated character in Star Trek. Like, if you calculated a total net dislike, Wesley would probably come out on top. Would be my guess.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, a fair assessment of the situation.
Yeah. And I mean, I think part of it is just that Wesley is the most memorable feature of season one. Like, you know, it's like when you think of season one, it's hard not to think of Wesley saving the ship like five times, right? And that's, you know, he takes over the ship when they're all drunk. And then he saves them from the problem that he caused. And then, you know, the traveler shows up and literally tells them that Wesley is destined for greatness. And so a lot of, you know, Wesley is sort of symbolic of, like, the weirdest excesses the show went to in its, like, early days, I think. But
yeah,
there are.
I think, you know, at least with the traveler, at least they sort of explained why he was so much incredibly smarter than everyone else. They didn't really explain it well, but they were like, oh, you're evolving to this higher plane of existence. And then you're like, okay, well, at least now it sort of makes sense why he outsmarted everyone else who had been to Starfleet Academy on a weekly basis.
Look, I've seen what happens when humans evolve to a higher state. They become newts, all right? Did nobody else see that episode? But there are actually two episodes that are Wesley-centered that I actually think are very good. I complain about Wesley all the time, so I wanted to switch it up a little bit and talk about the episodes where I like him. And those are The First Duty and, oh gosh, I have the second one written down and I've forgotten it. Why am I so terrible? Final Mission, that's the one.
I went to rewatch Final Mission because you mentioned we were going to talk about it, and the ending, or well, basically like the last third of the episode is really excellent. And the whole thing, the story is good, and the pacing is really interesting. That's the one where Wesley and Picard and this miner get like stranded on a planet, and then Picard's really seriously injured. And Wesley's interactions with Captain Picard are really, really emotional and feel really genuine compared to a lot of other stuff Wesley does. But the beginning of the episode, he's still really irritating. Primarily, he's really classist towards the miner. Like, he goes and the miner captain, like, comes on board with his shuttle and he's like, oh, I'm Captain whatever, like, I forget what his name is. And Wesley's like, a captain of a mining ship. And,
what a pleb.
And he's, Yeah, and he goes like, "Oh yeah, this cat—it's a ship. It's important, and I have a lot of experience. Stop being snotty." And then he critiques the equipment again when they're in the ship, and then later when they're down on the planet, the guy like is dying from dehydration, like all of them, and he kind of stumbles, and then Picard is like, "And you," or sorry, not Picard, Wesley is like, "And you were worried that Picard wasn't tough enough?" So he's
Look,
basically like
never
a
the
total
star.
jerk to this minor guy. And then later, Picard's like, you have to tell him that, or you have to get him under control because he could be dangerous. And Wesley has a hard time doing that, which probably would have been easier if he had been nice to the guy from the beginning.
Look,
But
Wesley
overall,
is.
it's a good episode.
Yeah, I was gonna say Wesley is still following the season two Starfleet handbook, which is that you have to be really disdainful to anyone who isn't in Starfleet. It's just like the way, and you're right. Like at the beginning when he's like, "This what, captain of a mining shuttle? Like who does he think he is? A real person?" It does sort of have, you know, it does have very uncomfortable, like, you know, educated bourgeoisie hating on the person who works with his hands kind of undertones.
Well, I don't know about that.
You don't think so, Bob?
Well, I think his life experience up until that point has been seeing Captain Picard and other Starfleet captains go about their business on a very, you know, complex operation where it is like a, you know, US Navy carrier group rolled into one little ship along with a lot of other scientific duties. So what Wesley has in his mind for what a starship captain is doing from day to day is very different from what someone of a, you know, captain of a mining shuttle would be doing. You know, this is just a classic, you know, book smart versus street smart, you know, thing. And Picard just have that, you know, moment where he coaches Wesley on it's like, you know, it doesn't matter what kind of what the ship is, you know, it's his ship, he's the captain of it. So if anything, it's not I don't think it should be viewed as, oh my God, look at Wesley, he's so dumb because he's, you know, being classist so much as, hey, look at this inexperienced guy getting, you know, some coaching from someone who is more experienced. And we get this in our daily lives from our elders, our bosses, our peers. These are all things that happen in our daily lives. And that was just happened to be a moment that was captured on TV.
I
Yeah,
suppose
that
fair
makes
enough.
sense, except for that after Picard corrects him the first time, he does like two or three more kind of snotty comments like that. And there's another time when Picard sort of intervenes again and is like, hey, you know, let's be polite to this guy because we're all just stuck here. So he wasn't really getting the message very easily.
All right, so
Well,
I've
that's
got.
going to be a that's a muscle memory thing where Wesley needs to check himself before he wrecks himself, but he doesn't have that life experience yet.
I've got it. I've got
And
it. I've figured
that's
out.
just being coached, so.
So you guys all remember what happened the last time Wesley ran into a like captain of a very small ship who was all like roguish and not part of the Federation, right? That was
You
the
must be
out.
talking about the outrageous O'Connor.
I am. And you recall how in that episode Wesley like hero worshipped that guy, right? Because like, you know, he was a stupid young child and thought the guy was cool for some reason. So he's probably spent every day since then being like, God, I acted like such a moron. Everyone must think I'm being such a. And he sees this guy, and he's like, I am not going to do that again. Like, I am not going to fawn over you. I am going to show everyone that I'm mature and that I'm too good for this. And you are, and that's why. That's why he reacts so negatively, is because he just can't, he has never been able to live down the way he acted in the outrageous O'Connor.
That makes sense.
I dig it.
Well,
I'm a.
and this like grizzledy, scruffy, drunk guy in the desert, he's not like a charismatic swashbuckler, so he didn't get sucked into that whole mystique.
But the reason why I think this episode works as well as it does is basically, Jera, for exactly the reason you said, which is that at the end, even though this is another episode where Wesley saves the day, which are sort of notorious for not being very good, he has to like deal with actual problems, right? Like he does end up solving it through his smarts, but it's not in a really unbelievable, like, why is he smarter than everyone else way. It's just, you know, he was put in a difficult situation and he does the best he can and he tries to rely on Picard, but Picard ends up having to rely on him because he's, you know, been injured so badly.
Yeah, it's really nice to see him have self-doubt once in a while.
Yeah, and I also think this is a good episode for the whole message of maybe you shouldn't just shoot phasers at it, because
Yeah.
like, even though they do end up solving the problem partially with a phaser, you know, you have the I don't remember the mining captain's name, but you know, he thinks they can solve the problem just...
His name's Durgo.
Durgo, yeah. He thinks they can solve the problem just by, you know, turning up the power on their phasers, right? Like, he's just gonna be like, we can brute force our way through this problem. And it's nice to see an episode where they really... Because sometimes Star Trek kind of comes off as being a little bit holier than thou in that area. It's like, well, no, we can't use force because we're too good for that. But here it's like, you know, maybe you shouldn't just attack something you don't understand, right? Because that could have negative, you know, that could have a backlash. So, I like that episode a lot. I like the ending in particular. And you're right, Jared. At the beginning, he's still kind of insufferable. But and the other one...
What was the other one? I was just going to say, what was the other episode again?
I was going to say the other episode is the First Duty, which is...
Oh, yeah.
Which is the episode where, if anyone doesn't remember, Wesley is at the academy and he gets in trouble because his something went awry during one of the maneuvers that he and his flight squadron were doing, and it turns out they were doing a really like illegal maneuver, and like they lied to cover it up, and it all goes downhill from there.
The Culverd Starburst or something like that. Yeah, it was like Blue Angel. Type, you know, maneuvers where it was a stunt stuff that they weren't really supposed to do, and it was banned, and one of the other cadets dies, and we get the origin of Tom Paris, but not called Tom Paris.
We also get Ensign Seto, who we see later. Of course, I guess she's not an ensign at that point, but...
Yeah, I was going to say Seto Jaxa, I think is her name, yeah, because she shows up in the Lower Decks, and she's a really great character there. But this is another episode where they use Wesley the way, I think if he'd been written this way from the beginning of the episode, from the beginning of the series, we wouldn't hate him. Like, I think he'd actually has the potential to be a really good character, as we see here. Because again, he's uncertain, right? Like, and Jerry, you pointed out, this is exactly what they did in the final mission, is that he isn't just like, I know what to do magically because I'm the smartest.
Yeah.
Like, he's talented, but he has this conflict of what exactly he should be doing. And, you know, I don't know. I really like it. I think the emotional conflict is really good. Bob, what did you think about it?
Well, kind of what I mentioned about Final Mission is that this is, well, lead into it anyway. Wesley in the series never really had an opportunity to be on his own. He never moved out of his mom's house. You know, his mom moved out of the house for a year, but that was it. He was still in the house, though. So... He hadn't, up until that point, had an opportunity to go get his own life experience that wasn't really in, you know, as safe an environment as it could be on the Enterprise, being the Enterprise faced danger and destruction every week. But, you know, he had Captain Picard, Will Riker, Data, Geordi, you know, Worf kind of to some extent, and his mom, all keeping him on the really straight and narrow and keeping his head in the books, you know, and he was very smart as a result of that. And a lot of things that came up were very technical. So now we have in these two episodes, you know, Wesley being put in a position where, hey, here, there's some stuff coming up here where, you know, life experience goes a really, really long way. And guess what? I don't have any. I don't really have any good life experience yet. With being, you know, outside of the Enterprise is always kind of this safe place for him to be, you know, at least as far as his surroundings went, and it was a very positive place, you know. So when he's confronted with these different situations, he's got no cushion like the rest of us do, you know, that have lived in the world for, you know, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, all up into our, you know, 50s and 60s and such before we retire. You know, and that's what these episodes are illustrating, is that, you know, academia can only get you so far. You've really got to live a little bit first on your own to understand what it is that's going on in the world, and then use that experience to guide you in the rest of your life.
Which is ironic, because that's sort of the opposite of what looks like it should be happening with Wesley, because he starts off with, you know, what you would think would be all this real experience where he's on an actual ship, right? Like, he's just, like, doing work. And then he runs into problems at the academy, which is where you would be figuring he'd be getting all the academic lessons.
Yeah, but it's all encompassing. And, you know, he's got a lot of the technical knowledge from being on that starship, a whole boatload of it, a lot more than probably a lot of the first year students at the academy had. He didn't have the good life experience, though. That's what he was lacking, the social life experience.
Well, and yes. I think another reason, you know, it doesn't really touch on the Durgo part, but especially in the academy, on the Enterprise, he was always in a, like a command structure, the hierarchy structure, but it was always people that were older than him or higher ranking than him. He never really had peers. So then when he goes to the Academy, he's with people his own age, and they're not the captain of the starship, even though there's the Red Squad and they have the team leader. He kind of doesn't have the same environment or structure around him. So I think that's why he was easily manipulated or, you know, pushed into one direction. And then he had to like be told, you know, you're going in the wrong way, basically. Because, and even on the Enterprise, he never really had a peer group. That it was like either we only ever saw him with younger children, like basically almost, you know, toddlers or very young children, and then adults. It was never a case of him being surrounded by other highly gifted people of his age. Because we've seen it in the real world where there's like a, you know, a 12-year-old that goes to college. Then there's, you know, Doogie Howser and all. There's the example of the child prodigy. But usually, you know, or sometimes it's good for them to be around others of that same, you know, ilk or whatever. And he never got that. So it was always mentors, and then when he gets to the Academy, he's kind of like fish out of water, that he doesn't know how to handle that scenario so much.
Yeah, he isn't really
right. Exactly, it's like exactly what David is saying, you know. And he's been so socially engineered now at this point to be such a pleaser, you know. That's very obvious, you know, first, second, third season Wesley, that he just wants to be, he wants to make people, you know, proud of him. He wants to make sure people are happy about what he's got going on, what his accomplishments are. So I'm not really surprised he found himself in the situation he did in First Duty, despite his right and wrong, you know, senses tinkling.
Right. I mean, it makes perfect sense. It's one of the reasons why I think the First Duty is a really great episode. My point was that if they had written him more like that in the previous seasons, I don't think he would have been as disliked as he is, because, you know, the two things that really define these episodes and make them good is that he has to struggle a bit. You know, he has to really face a problem, whereas almost every other Wesley episode is him just doing things because he's so naturally amazing at them. Now,
yeah,
this is
I agree. I also think that part of what makes these two episodes really successful is Wesley's dynamic with Picard. And I mean, there's definitely changes that both of them undergo up to those later episodes. And the fact that they had, so yes, objectively Wesley was annoying to begin with, but having Picard be really grumpy about him, I don't think really helped the situation, because it set it up where Wesley had to prove himself by like being the super genius kid, and it was still easier for the audience to find him annoying because the captain thought he was annoying.
Yeah, and Picard is most people's favorite character when they're watching the show. Maybe, you know, so with Data being another possible exception. Now, this is a kind of a little interesting bit of trivia that I've uncovered, and I think I knew about it before, but I'd forgotten, is that Bob Justman had originally lobbied for the character to be female, because, and according to him, like, everyone was doing teenage boy characters at that point, and they were like, maybe it would be interesting if we did a character that was an adolescent female, and looked at it from that perspective. Jared, do you think that would have been like interesting, or would they just have butchered it and that would be like, you know, and that would have just done damage to female characters down the line?
Well, I think it would have been interesting to have another female character, and, you know, someone who is more geeky, I guess, in Next Generation. But you know, given that at the beginning of the series, when the show was being created, that there was so much of that feeling that, you know, people and children in the future won't have problems, I think that she would have had the same issue that would have been written as sort of unnaturally gifted and problem-free. And that wouldn't really have been good for, I don't think it was good for Wesley, and it probably wouldn't have been good for a female character.
Yeah, I agree. Especially with how, like, anytime that you have a female character that is like, you know, that is good at something, you always get the accusations of being a Mary Sue. And Wesley actually kind of is a Mary Sue, in that he's sort of a self-insert for Gene Roddenberry. And I think that would have just, people probably just would have been even angrier than they already are.
Yeah, he's a Marty Stew.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that also how you view the character depends a lot on how old you were when you first watched it. Or, when you most recently watched it, because I definitely find that when I first watched it and I was a little kid, I didn't notice issues. I was just like, oh, there's a kid on the ship. That's really cool. But now I'm going like, what an annoying kid.
Yeah, I'll cop to that. When I first watched it and I was a teenager, like 13 or 14, I thought Wesley was cool 'cause, but by the same token, I would have thought he was just as cool if he'd been a better character, right? Like,
Yeah,
this wasn't that
totally.
I thought he was cool because he was a bad character, which is I was too young to know the difference.
Yep, that's very, very good point. In addition, another just like episode where he doesn't play a major role, but I think he does a good decent job is the one where there's the boy Timothy whose parent has died, and he tries to be like Data, and then Wesley goes and like talks to him about what it was like when his father died, and again, it just like helps to humanize him and
Yeah.
show that he has feelings and issues.
Wasn't that hero worship, I think, with the little kid wanting to be dated. Yeah, I think it was social awkwardness, and not that he like would fumble and trip or anything, but not knowing how to, not having peers to relate to, but then not being able to relate to, the older adults. But it kind of made me think when I was back when I was watching it, I accepted that he was like a Doogie Howser, or like that whole idea of the child prodigy, the super smart, just gifted. But then I thought they handled it. They didn't really handle it well because he always saved the day. And you got Data, you got Geordi, and they can't figure out a thing. But here comes, Mozart of warp theory or whatever, and he just solves it. I thought they could have done it more subtle, where being a kid, he would be on the same level as Geordi and them sometimes, and just contribute to the solution, not just like they can't figure it out and only Wesley can save the day. I think that was overdoing it, and so some people that it just added to the fact of people. It's like, why is this little kid the only one that could solve the problem or swoop in and save the day? Because it was like just not really as believable that you have the flagship of the Federation, the top site, the top crew, and they have to rely on Wesley to do stuff.
And
And
why
it
did he
kind
have to
of.
save the ship in those sweaters all the time?
Yeah, always with the sweaters. And there's also like it goes beyond science a little bit too, with like in Data lore, for some reason Wesley is the only one who notices that Data is acting really out of character. And it's like, why specifically is he the only one who notices? It's like, Wesley and Data aren't even shown to be particularly close until that episode. Granted, I don't know if they'd
Well,
started.
I the reason why I accepted or just bought into the connection or whatever between him, Wesley and Data was basically Data at times was shown to almost be like a child mind, or the naive or the innocent or just not jaded or, and so I could kind of understand there being, even though we didn't see it that often, I just kind of thought, okay, yeah, that makes sense. Wesley would go hang out with Data because Data wouldn't condescend to Wesley. They would just, but then, like you just said, if anybody would spot weirdness in Data, it should have been Geordi noticing different ticks or different behavior changes, because Data and Geordi were supposed to be so best friends and spend all the time together.
Or Counselor Troi, because she's supposed to understand behavior.
Yeah, and be a counselor.
Look, we would literally be here all day if we counted every time they should have had Troi point out something that a character was acting strange, and then they didn't.
Fair
'Cause
enough.
I think that would be a majority of TNG episodes. But if you guys are up for this, I would like to compare Wesley with Jake Sisko a little bit. Because I feel like Jake Sisko, although he isn't the greatest character, I think he did a lot of the things right that Wesley did wrong, and I don't mean in character, I mean in terms of how they were developed by the writers.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Also, they're around sort of the same age through the 7 seasons, so it makes sense to look at them side by side.
Yeah,
And they
because
both
so
have bad clothes.
they do both have bad clothes. Although Jake grows out of it a little bit. Jake, starts when he starts dressing himself, he has a little bit more style.
Well, and there's less Mary Sue factor with Jake. I mean, for one, they're not saying that he's like a child prodigy, Mozart, gonna be destined for such greatness, and so you just start off accepting him as a kid, a normal, citizen, non-Starfleet person, obviously because he's a kid, but as he even gets older, he's not just following the Starfleet track. So I think Jake feels more real, or just more of a like a well-rounded character. It's not just like, oh he's the problem solver, the genius kid. And then we get to see he has, to me, I think he even has a little bit better of a development arc over the course of the season, even though Wesley gets his powers and, you know, has his whole teenager angst stuff. I think Jake was developed better, but I think maybe that's because they learn lessons from Jake, I mean, from Wesley.
Yeah, because Jake, I mean, like, Jake is obviously not, like you said, he's not supposed to be a prodigy, right? Like, he isn't a child genius. So that it makes him easier for us to relate to, at least at the very beginning, because I don't know how many of us were child geniuses, but at least I wasn't. So that makes it a little bit easier for us as adults now to relate to him, because we can kind of see the problems that he was going through and be like, yeah, okay, I remember when I was having those problems, when I was really, really nervous to try to ask out somebody I liked on a date, things like that. And I think, and they also, like, Jarrah, you mentioned that when Wesley was good, it was when he was, his relationship with Picard was used well. Mm-hmm. I think with Jake, they kind of baked that in better, because Jake is actually Sisko's son. And so a lot of the good Jake moments are played between him and Sisko.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the biggest example of that is The Visitor, which is a lot of people's favorite DS9 episode. And that's the one, for anyone who doesn't remember, where Sisko gets thrown into like some kind of weird subspace dimension. And he only shows up in the real world like once every 40 years or something. And so it's a sort of a flash forward episode, because Jake has to go on living his life. And he becomes an old man played by, who was he played by? David, remind me.
Tony Todd.
Kern. Yeah, yep. Who's a badass. And so that entire episode is sort of based on the relationship between Jake and his father. And it's, you know, it's very poignant and very successful.
And that's kind of in the mid range of Jake is as the character, because it's not the later seasons where he's like basically almost a young adult, like basically an adult doing the journalism. And it's not when he's the really young kid. It's right in the mid range. So I think, you know, that time with him and Sisko, that's the other thing between, I mean, we had a mentorship, kind of a father figure or a mentor dynamic between Wesley and Picard, but with Jake, it's actually his father, and there's times where you see those struggles of parenting, and so, you know, that lends more to the Jake character. Sometimes we see it from Sisko's point of view, but it is, you know, addressing the Jake character. So the father-son dynamic, I think, was done really well. And I know some people have issues with it, because later in the seasons, like, they say Sisko was a bad father for going off with the prophets or whatever. But I think, like, episode to episode, and then here, like, as you follow it, I think it was one of the best or better examples of a single father dealing with raising a young son that's been on television, not just in sci-fi or Star Trek, but kind of on TV in general. We don't really see a lot of examples of a single father trying to raise a child to a young man. And so I think, you know, and they didn't go overboard with it. They didn't, you know, overdo it. But it's just nice to see, you know, the father-son dynamic done the way they did it. But I think another aspect that helps Jake is the fact that he has Nog. I mean, he has a peer. And, you know, they go back and forth and they have their own stuff. But I think having Nog improves the Jake character. So I think it's just Jake has things going for it as a character that Wesley is not. I mean, and I think maybe that is because they learn lessons from it. But also it's just a different story, different dynamic and environment that it felt more real and more natural and more fleshed out.
Yeah, I was going to say that. I think the having Nog around helped, but also the fact that, you know, when we first started to get Wesley episodes, Wesley was often like pretty much at the center of the plot. And the episodes when Jake's a kid, he's usually part of the B plot and something to do with like Nog and sometimes Quark or Keiko or something. So I think it's like it's a little bit less pressure on his character, and he can just come off being kind of more a normal kid. I just watched Progress the other day when him and Nog in the self-sealing stem bolts at Grace's request. And it's just a fun little B plot. It's not anything that you could say like that's a horribly unrealistic child or an annoying child. It's just like, oh yeah, those are some kids doing a kid thing.
You get
there's
the same
a little
thing.
More. There's a little more humor with Jake because of Nog, but just in general. And Wesley didn't really get the, like, just the fun of being a kid and some of that comedy. So that I think that also hurt Wesley. And later, as Jake progresses, I mean, I just saw the episode. I just watched Negus, which is where Zek, you know, fakes his death and puts Quark as the Grand Negus. And that's the main plot. But the secondary plot is the whole, you know, going to school for Nog, and Rom takes him out of school, and we see that Sisko thinks that Jake and Nog just run off and get into mischief, and we've seen them do that at times, but in this episode we see that they go to a cargo bay and Jake is teaching Nog to read, you know, and so Sisko is like, okay, cool, go be with your friend. That's kind of like a win. If you, the way I'm thinking of it is almost like that's a win for Jake. That, you know, he wasn't a troublemaker. They weren't getting into mischief. He was doing a good thing. Whereas when Wesley has his wins, it's almost like tarnished because, well, you're the child prodigy. You're the Mozart. You're the, you know, the super genius. And then you're going to save the day. You don't really, like, celebrate Wesley's little wins or saving the day as much as Jake, even though it's a smaller thing. But it's more like socializing. And it's like, I don't want to, it's not a humanitarian, I don't think that's the right way, but he's doing something good, even though it's not saving the ship or saving the world. But you sell, it's like better when Jake does those type of things. And then later when he becomes a writer, he's not saving the universe, but he's doing good things. And I think it's easier to go along with that or to celebrate it. And because he's not like Mr. Save the Day.
Yeah, I agree. And you guys have both, Jarrah and David and Bob too, you all talked about the Jake and Nog friendship, which I think is part of what makes Jake work as a character, is that he has this very, you know, at first troubled, but then, you know, close relationship with Nog. And like, I think that's one of the triumphs of Star Trek's message of inclusiveness to me, because at the beginning, you know, you sort of have sort of Rom too, but mainly Sisko is opposed to their friendship because he sees the Ferengi as, you know, and to an extent he's correct, as being backwards and obviously really sexist and having a lot of, you know, not really stuff you want to be associated with in their culture. But at the same time, you know, Jake shows that you can't judge an individual based on broad cultural traits. And I just think that worked really, really well in those particulars.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't feel particularly kind to the Shellyak personally, but you know.
Well, I mean, the Shellyak are a little bit of a different kettle of fish myself, but you know.
No, what happened to not judging the culture in broad strokes? Or
I'm just saying, we only ever saw one Shellyak, and he, she, it was kind of a jerk.
Maybe Jarrah, the rest say something? Are really I feel nice.
Like. Say what that?
I said maybe the rest are really nice.
They could be. You don't know. Now, there is one Jake episode that is kind of obnoxious that I feel like we should mention, which is The Muse, if anyone remembers that one. It's the one where I don't remember what's happening in the B plot, but the A plot is Jake.
It's Loxana and Odo in the B plot.
Oh, is that what's happening? Okay.
Yeah.
So the A plot is Jake getting his...
That's
getting...
one where they gotta get married, right?
Yeah.
It's like, I don't even really know how to describe it exactly. Like, Jake meets this alien who brings out his hidden talent, but it's like killing him to do that.
That's basically it.
That's what's happening.
Yeah.
And Jarrah, I know you've talked about this episode before. You wanna comment on what's the problems it's got going on?
Yeah, and Shran brought it up in the chat room, and I think probably most of us agree that it is a pretty terrible episode. I actually don't like either plot, but the Jake plot in particular. Oh, it's just, it's so weird. So, I mean, one thing I like is I kind of like that he lies to his dad to, like, stay on the ship and keep working with this woman who she's like, I'm going to bring out your secret writing talent. And I think, like, that's a cool again, like, to just show he's not perfect and that he would do a normal teenager thing, like lie to like hang out with this woman. But it's pretty creepy. And it looks sort of like she's like getting off touching his head while he is like writing, and then he starts like bleeding out of his nose, I think.
Yep.
And it turns out, yeah, it's basically like killing him, but he's able, like, she's stimulating his brain so that he can write this masterpiece of a story. I forget which writer it was. I'll have to look it up, but basically said that, like, yeah, we wrote this because it's awesome, because like every writer wants to think about like some woman just like getting off watching me write. Gross.
Yeah, which is interesting, because before I saw that, because I've read the same quote you did. I think it was from Ron Moore, actually.
Oh, yeah, it was.
Like, I've read that same quote, which is odd, because when I watched that episode, I thought it was a completely different weird writer fantasy, which is that like, a lot of writers, and I've been guilty of this myself sometimes, we have this fantasy that we are sacrificing for our art, right? Like, you know, we will die, or something bad will happen to us, or whatever, but it's okay because we will be forever remembered because we were so brilliant in the words that we put down on the page, right? Like, it's a weird self-aggrandizement thing that I've noticed some writers have, and that's what I thought it was when I first watched it.
Yeah. Yeah, the quote says, like, this is a real writer's show. The idea that you would sit someplace and write, and as you're writing, a woman is getting off on your writing. That's the most inside writer's fantasy you can imagine. I don't know if anything else is quite like those scenes. He's writing, putting words on paper, and she's coming on to him. These are, like, our fantasies. And I'm like, chalk that up to things I did not want to know about Ron Moore.
Yeah, you know, it's definitely not. It's a very odd episode, which it's also, like, it's kind of even, like, a little forgettable because it doesn't really show up again. There's another episode that I think of, and this is more about Jake and Nog together, which I really like, which apparently lots of people don't like, and that is Valiant. Does everyone here remember that one?
Sort of.
Okay, well, Valiant
was a great episode.
So Valiant is a Deep Space Nine episode where Nog and Jake get attacked when they're in a runabout by the Dominion. And then they get rescued by a Defiant class ship, which is manned by Red Squad, which is a group of cadets that we've never seen them before, but we've heard about them. And they're like some kind of elite cadet squad or whatever.
Hey, you know that Galactic Power we're having like really high tensions with? Let's go take a ship out with some cadets and go run some drills. Yeah, that sounds like a great idea.
It'll be everything fine. Nothing could possibly go wrong with this strategy. But
wasn't Red Squad like the name of the Locarno and Wesley, weren't they in Red Squad?
No, I don't think so. Locarno.
Two references. There's Nova Squad and there's Red Squad.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah, Red Squad was specifically mentioned in the two-parter Homefront, and I don't remember what the second one was called, but it was, you know, the one with the Starfleet Admiral who tries to launch a coup. But they, you know,
Admiral Layton. Yeah. He knows what's up. His foreign policy, best foreign policy.
Yeah. So they mentioned him there. But anyway, so they have this ship because they were on a training exercise when the war started and all the actual officers died. And it's, you know, they are a little bit annoying, right? Like, just a little bit. But they're clearly, like, really full of themselves, and they think that they're the greatest, and they have this one kind of cult-like scene in the meeting room where they all start chanting Red Squad. Except for this one Vulcan in the background who isn't. I wonder what's up with him. I'd like to know his deal. And then they try to destroy this giant Dominion warship, which they then fail to do, right? And I actually really like that episode because I feel like it is it's kind of exactly what you said, Bob, is that it is a ship full of Wesley Crushers. Like, you know,
that's not exactly what I said, but...
Well, I mean, specifically is that these are all geniuses, right? Like, these kids were all at the top of their class. They all, like, you know, were voted most likely to succeed or what have you. They all have all this knowledge, but they don't have any life experience. So you've got the captain. I don't remember his name, but you've got the captain, and he knows academically... What?
Just when Trance in the chat, the Vulcan doesn't chant because he's an extra.
Yeah, like, he couldn't afford his speaking lines for him.
Chanting is illogical.
But, like, so you've got the captain who is a, you know, who academically he knows that a good captain is always there for his crew and, like, you know, is all, you know, helps them out and always has an ear to listen. But the way that manifests for him is that he's taking stimulants to stay awake when he doesn't really need to. And he's really nosy, right? Like, he's just getting into his crew's business and being like, what's going on with you, engineering lieutenant? And she's like, I don't really want to talk to you. And he's like, but tell me, because I'm your captain.
And was he carrying one of those scepters like that other guy?
Got a swagger stick. That's what that thing is called. It's called a swagger stick. And you've got, you know, you've got the same thing with their first officer, who she knows that a first officer's, you know, job is to maintain discipline and to, you know, keep everything running correctly so the captain can look at big picture stuff. But the way that manifests is that she's like really aggressive towards her crew and comes off as being very unlikable. And so, you know, that, and I think, I think that was kind of a neat idea, was to sort of take the idea of child geniuses and be like, well, this is why you kind of need some life experience. 'Cause just knowing academically how it works is maybe not, you know, it's not going to cut it for you. And I think that might be like, I might be the only one who has ever analyzed Valiant in this manner. 'Cause a lot of people just sort of write it off as being that sort of annoying episode where they go on a ship full of children.
Well, I think more the sticking point for a lot of people is, I mean, these are all good points that you bring up. I mean, you know, they're looking at the academics of this and their life experience is minimal at best. So now, what bothers me about Valiant in particular is that there would have been very specific briefing instructions on if these things occur. You know, I do private security, and it's not like rocket science. I'm not like a cop or anything like that, but we have, you know, operating procedures for particular instances when things happen. And I'm sure there's an emergency procedure saying if Starfleet captain and Starfleet first officer who are overlooking cadets is dead, proceed back to Federation space. I'm positive that that was in there somewhere. It seems to have been blatantly ignored, and all these cadets get together like, you know, that's a great idea. Let's go ahead and hunt some Dominion.
Yeah, well, they're clearly pretty full of themselves, right? I mean, they mentioned specifically that Starfleet doesn't know that the officers are all dead. It does seem odd that even thinking that the officers were still alive, Starfleet would send them out on a mission. It seems like it would have been more valuable to bring the ship back and put a real crew on it.
Was there no emergency command hologram on that ship that could have taken help?
I don't think he was invented yet.
Oh, darn.
Oh, God, emergency command hologram. That is a complete other discussion I would love to have at some point.
You know, so, but, and it's even stranger, I think, that, you know, Nog gets sucked into this thing. I mean, he is also lacking that same life experience. I mean, he's an ensign now. He's been through the academy a little bit, so he's got a little bit of experience, and he's been on Deep Space Nine, which is, you know, much more the mean streets than the Enterprise is for Wesley Crusher, you know. But I'm still surprised that Nog got sucked into that whole thing. And if anything, Nog should have taken command, because he's actually a legit officer, and they're not.
Yeah, he, you know, does outrank
it's,
all of
it's,
them.
It takes Jake to be like, guys, this is, like, not the right thing to be doing. This is dumb. I don't think you guys realize how dumb this is.
To be fair, the thing that I liked, talking about the actual two characters we were mentioning in the beginning, is that I like how in this episode, Nog, this is basically the first time Nog has received what he's really wanted, which is validation from other members of Starfleet. Because, you know, we've seen the way Federation people talk about Ferengi, right? Like, there's a lot of casual racism towards Ferengi in Starfleet and in the Federation in general. And we know from, you know, the brief experiences we had with Nog at the Academy that he is having a very difficult time of it. And even when he comes back to Deep Space Nine, he's kind of just, you know, he's just a regular guy now. And so here we have a group of people who he's looked up to when he was in the Academy actually telling him, you are as awesome as you would like us to think you are. And, you know, to that, there is a certain amount of, I don't want to say brainwashing exactly, but there's a certain amount of cultishness there, where, like, they're appealing to his ego and telling him everything he wants to hear. And Jake, who is outside of that command structure, is the one who's like, you know, Nog, you've taken this way too far. Like, you know, this is clearly not going to work. I don't know. I liked it. Maybe I'm putting stuff on it that isn't there, but I thought it was good.
Yeah, I thought that the dynamic of Nog sort of getting peer pressured actually made sense. And also because Jake has sort of been a bit more independent and artist-y, that it makes sense that he'd be, he's also like very observant of dynamics. So it makes sense that he would be the one who's sort of trying to view it from the outside and get a whole picture before making a decision.
I also just love how their technobabble explanation completely didn't work. Like, you know, they do that a lot in Star Trek, right? Where they're like, we'll solve it with tech. And then they did that and it didn't work. And I don't know. That filled me with joy.
You talking about how they're going to go after the Dominion Dreadnought?
Yeah, they were like, well, the Dominion Dreadnought is like 5 times bigger than us and has all these guns. But if we hit them in this technical weakness that somehow they overlooked and do this thing with this kind of radiation at this point, it'll totally just, you know, go away and explode. And, you know, there are a number of Star Trek episodes that have ended that way, right? Where they have just done that and it worked. And I don't know, the fact that it didn't work this time made me happy. You know, I appreciate that they couldn't just technobabble their way out of a problem. Now, the next character on our list is someone we were talking about a little bit in the beginning, which is Naomi Wildman from Voyager. And this is, Jarrah helpfully provided me with a list that says all the episodes that Naomi Wildman was in and what she did in those episodes. So I guess I'll start with by asking you guys what you guys think of Naomi Wildman, because I'm not really sure. I'm a little bit on the fence about her character. Bob, what do you think?
I try not to think about Voyager too hard a lot of the time, so you may have to jog my memory too.
All right, so
I'm a little bit on the fence as well. When I thought about doing this episode, the main thing I remembered about Naomi Wildman from the first time that I watched Voyager when it was first airing, and I was, I was a tween, and I remembered that my friend and I really used to make fun of the scene in Mortal Coil where she is going, Neelix, tell me about the Great Forest. And I told my friend and I was like, were we making fun of it because we didn't like her? It sort of seemed like we were a bit older. So we were just like, oh, we're cooler than this little kid. And I think that I like her better than Wesley, but less than Jake. And that also ties in with how well developed and nuanced she is, which is to say, she has some normal kid issues, like not being able to go to sleep without someone telling her a story, but she also is kind of freakishly super smart and like piloting a shuttle when she's like 4 years old or something.
Is that a thing she does? When does she do that?
Well, in Bliss in the beginning. Well, I mean, Paris is there, but he like lets her like plot a route back to the ship. And I'm like, really?
I mean, it's the Star Trek equivalent of having your kids sit on your lap and put their hands on the steering wheel while you have your hands there to make sure they don't drive off into a ditch, right?
Yeah, except for like they're in the middle of the Delta Quadrant and there's bad aliens everywhere.
Well, that's true, but if they let that affect their planning, they wouldn't send off shuttles to do side missions while Voyager hung out and did nothing.
No, that's cool. They've got a whole bunch of shuttles, remember?
That is a thing that, you know, that Voyager did a lot, where they would send a shuttle off to do some mission, and we'd be like, what was Voyager doing that they couldn't just take Voyager to do it? And the answer is nothing. Voyager was just hanging out, and they sent a shuttle off because they like to put their crew in danger sometimes. Keeps life interesting. Sorry, Jar, I interrupted you.
Oh, no worries. That agreed. But I think that the most important thing to note with Naomi is that a lot of the time she's more there to tell us things about the other characters than she is there to be a fully formed character in her own right. Like she plays a really important role in helping Seven learn and develop and become humanized, and in some episodes with Neelix that are better than others. I actually don't mind Mortal Coil, and I think that she has a role in, showing him that he can be caring without being super creepy sometimes.
Yeah, which is something Neelix really needed. You know, if we were gonna not throw him out the airlock, he needed to show that he was a little bit more than just creepster A number one.
Yeah. And I do like that she's like a little girl who sees herself as potentially being in command of a ship one day, that she likes, you know, play, pretend being captain and things like that. And, you know, makes sense when the only, like, the role model that she has is Captain Janeway. But I think it is cool to see a little girl who has that kind of aspirations.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, some of her, you know, cute, really adorable moments are the ones where she's talking about being captain's assistant. And I think that she, for the most part, is shown to be intelligent without wandering into Wesley territory. Like, you know, she's doing schoolwork and writing reports and, you know, sitting on Paris's lap and driving the ship, kind of. But mainly, I think you're right. I think her main role in the show is to sort of help develop Seven's character, because like Seven is also has certain aspects of being a child, in that she's learning how to be a human, how to be an individual again, and like the Naomi is one of the only crew members who can interact with her on not exactly equal footing, but like without all the baggage that all the other crewmen have, because the other crew is all like, well, you used to be a Borg, and it's, I can't just forget that when we're talking. Whereas like with Naomi, it never mattered, so it was like, you know, whatever. To Naomi, Seven's just a particularly interesting person. One thing that I wish they'd done more with was Naomi's mother. Like,
yeah,
maybe,
yeah, that's what I used to always think about that.
Like, maybe this was a budget issue, but like, I mean, on Deep Space Nine, they managed to find room for Nog and Rom, you know, in the budget. And, you know, Rom became a character in his own right and was interesting, but like Samantha Wildman, I think, is in maybe two episodes that also feature Naomi, and Naomi is in a lot of episodes, and it just kind of feels...
That was the kind of the thing. Aside from saying I wish there was more episodes where there was kind of, you know, getting, not overly delving too far into it, but like some of the parenting stuff, like what would life be like, you know, parenting when you're a Starfleet officer or when you're on a spaceship out in space. And aside from saying... aside from saying like it would be nice to see the parenting and the, from both sides, the mother and my thought was like, where is Samantha? We hardly, like, we didn't even see her walking in a hallway. It's like, she wasn't like, you know, bye, I got to go to work. And then that's why we don't see parenting or, you know, mother daughter ish, you know, not even just like the parent to child dynamic, just like the family time or them two, you know, looking at, it was just like, where is the mother? It's like, we never got that character much from that character.
Yeah, I don't know if they could have explained it better, at least. But in the episodes she is in, and again, it goes back to my point of why Naomi was there. Oftentimes, her job is just sort of handing Naomi off to someone else. So, like in Mortal Coil, she's in it, you know, always calling Neelix because Naomi wants to see her godfather to help her go to sleep. And if I was Neelix, I would get really tired of doing that every night. But, you know, it's that the point of having Naomi there in the first place wasn't to tell us anything about, like, really about her, about Samantha. It was about, like, the other principal characters.
Yeah, I really feel like the Naomi character would have worked better if she had been, like, an orphan that they found. Like, they just came, you know, they just came across her on a ship and they didn't know where she was from and they couldn't contact her people. So she just became like everyone's kid, because that way they wouldn't have had to deal with this sort of looming question of, well, she has a mom. Why is her mom so unimportant in her daily life? Right.
That could have fed into her attachment or a relationship with Seven, that it'd almost be like that she would have connected more with Seven than the, like, I like the idea, like you said, the everybody's kid, everybody helping take care of her, but she would attach herself to Seven being, you know, either relatable or just because, oh, you're cool or interesting, you're, you know, different than, so that would be an interesting take on it, as if they, you know, saved her somehow or saw that. And it's not just like, why aren't they picking up orphan kids or aliens left and right? It's like, it would have been something that, like, maybe she helped them or had a role that, you know, served a purpose. So they said, okay, you could join the crew. And then it become, it's just weird that, it was just always weird to me that both the Naomi and the Samantha, the Wildmans, that would have been a weird thing for me for Voyager.
Isn't she technically an orphan because she was brought on board by Kim through the spatial anomaly after the other Naomi died?
Yeah, I wonder if they ever told her about that. It's like, technically speaking, you're from an alternate timeline. You know, just saying. That would be a weird episode where they finally have the talk about what timeline she's from. She's like, what are you guys talking about? I don't understand.
And they're like, 20 years later, having this crazy existential crisis on some counselor's couch.
It's like,
it would be
it was
awesome
season,
if they it, got it, home and there was like something radically different in Kim's life, and Kim realized that like after 6 years or whatever, that he never realized that, I don't know, his, like he had a sister or something in this other. Oh, I guess it wasn't really like an alternate timeline. It was a duplication, but
somehow
anyway.
It was something. Okay. It was season two of Voyager.
We didn't
ask too many questions back then.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, I was just talking about how it might have been interesting if she'd been not actually a kid of anyone on board. They sort of did that with the Borg children, and then they kind of were like, we don't really know what we're doing with these kids, so we're gonna get rid of them because we can't afford to keep bringing the guest stars back every episode. They kept Ichab around, which I thought was kind of an odd choice.
Yeah.
He made the cut.
Yeah,
he was contributing enough to the ship to stay.
Especially the twins really didn't seem like they got used, and Ichab had more of a point. But it seems kind of weird because when you compare it with like the end seasons of Deep Space Nine, they had so much they were trying to cram in there, and when it gets to the Borg kids later in Voyager, you're like, why did they even waste time with this if they weren't going to go anywhere?
Yeah, like, they have them around for, like, two or three episodes, and then they're like, oh, we found some people who will take them from us. Okay.
Well, yeah, and they sort of take over a bit of Naomi's previous role in sort of, you know, her relationship with Seven, and we don't see her for that period of time. So it's interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. I think overall I was really glad to have Naomi, just because it's nice to see new stuff on Voyager, because, you know, again, like, Voyager is a ship that's cut off from the Federation, right? And they're like encountering all these new people and all these new things, and, you know, that's one of my problems with the show, is that it didn't feel like it changed enough, right? It really felt like it should have changed more as they went through all these challenges, and just, you know, having a few new faces around was kind of cool. And, you know, having like Seven at the same time we had Naomi was like, okay, you know, sure, why not? You know, I'm willing to excuse the 18-month gestation period and the fact that you are like 3, but you look like you're 12. Why not?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that with the Borg kids, that's another good example of sort of that Voyager problem of let's introduce a problem and then solve it a little bit too easily. I think someone in the chat room was pointing out that Ichab was like a bit like Wesley, and I think in terms of being super smart, that's true, but the main difference was he wasn't going around the ship being like, look how awesome I am, everyone, and like sort of treating everyone like they were his parents and trying to make them proud of him. So I find it a little bit easier to handle.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, the thing with Ichab that weirded me out was that, like, you know, so Naomi shows up in a lot of episodes where she isn't the central focus. Like, you know, she's around, right? Like, they just remind us, oh yeah, by the way, we have other characters on the ship other than the main cast members, which is cool. And if they'd done that more with Samantha Wildman, I think I would have liked it even more. But Ichab, like, I'm trying to remember, and I don't remember very many episodes that Ichab is in that aren't specifically about Ichab. Like, he's in the episode where they find his parents, and it turns out he was a virus bomb for the Borg, which is, you know, an interesting way of waging warfare, I guess. And then there's the episode where Seven of Nine's little tube of neon light is not working well. I forget what they call it. And like he makes the whole like, you can have mine even though that might kill me decision. So that one's like kind of really focused on him. And like there's the one where he is getting, he's like thinks B'Elanna is coming on to him, which is an uncomfortable episode to watch, certainly.
I did just watch the one where B'Elanna finds out she's pregnant and, like, Ichab is scanning her and is like, there's a life form inside Lieutenant Torres. It may be a parasite. And so that was kind of funny. And that's not an Ichab episode, but it's one he was in.
That's true. Maybe I'm just misremembering. Maybe I should give him a little more credit on that. But
like that episode that Chakotay died?
Oh, gosh.
Do you have that link still?
I could find it. Maybe I'll put it in the chat. Jera, I don't think you were here for this conversation.
No, I don't remember this.
All right, I'm going to fill you in real quick for anyone else who didn't hear this episode. There is a website called the Mandela Effect, and it's this journalist who apparently figured out that a lot of her colleagues had thought that Mandela had died in prison.
Right. And, okay, I did actually hear this episode where you talked about this.
Yeah, and then she was like, "This is evidence of multiple realities." And then there's an episode. Then like two people apparently thought that Chakotay had died in an episode, but he didn't. And then they were like, "Those people are from a reality where Chakotay died in an episode of Voyager." And I'm like, I mean, that's, you know, I've certainly wished that had happened a few times, but I think that mainly, I think there are simpler explanations.
It was a very scientific study, you understand.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think those are the big ones, right? Like, there are a few other kids that are recurring. Like, there's Molly, who shows up a few more times, but there's really only one episode where she's anything other than sort of an extension of the O'Brien marriage, which, heavens knows, that requires its own episode to get into that. And then there's, like, Alexander, who, I guess, maybe we could talk about Alexander a little bit. He was kind of a problematic
The first
character.
Thing you have written here is yuck under Alexander.
Yes.
The first thing I see in the show notes is yuck.
Well, what do you want from me? I can't pretend that I don't hate everything Alexander does to the story. Like, I don't really like Alexander. Like, he annoys me. But more importantly, I just don't like how, I've said this before, how Worf reacts to Alexander by going, like, who can I make this someone else's problem?
Just FYI for the audience that is listening, when I mentioned earlier that the word hate comes up four times in the document, two of those instances come up under the heading Alexander.
Yeah, Alexander bugs me way more than Wesley does, I'll admit. At least, you know, just because Wesley was kind of off doing his own thing, but Alexander is just like, hey, Worf, do you have a son? What are you going to do about that? It's like, I guess I am going to make it someone else's problem to deal with. Like, you know, I'll foist it off on my parents, and when I can't do that, I will just completely fall apart and not step up to the plate, like, even a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's the big problem with Alexander, and in a way, it's not necessarily just Alexander or, you know, dialogue or story in a particular episode. I think it's just the writers just dropped the ball big time. It's like, to me, not just one word, but my initial reaction, if somebody were to play the game where you have to say what comes to mind real quick or whatever, and they say Alexander, it's wasted potential and missed opportunities. Because I kind of like the idea that, you know, Worf is supposed to be, I got it all together, and I'm Mr. Klingon. I know all about the Klingon rituals and Klingon culture, and I'm like the super Klingon when it comes to living that lifestyle. But then I'm also,
oh man, Worf is the Wesley of the Klingon Empire.
Pretty much in ways, because then you got Worf being like, I'm Mr. Starfleet officer. Like, yes, I'm Mr. Klingon, but I'm also, you know, a super good example of a Starfleet officer, and so I have it all together. But then here comes the son, and he totally falls apart, and he don't know how to deal with it. He doesn't have all the answers. He doesn't know how to handle that situation. And I thought that would have been an interesting thing to do, because, for one, Alexander didn't want to go to be a Klingon warrior. So Worf can't just instill all of his knowledge and you know, passion and interest in, hey, let's be, you know, overly Klingon all the time. So he couldn't do that. So that takes that away. Alexander wouldn't have wanted, didn't want to, you know, do Starfleet, obviously. So it was a way that could have added to the Worf character, and also, you know, given an example of Worf having to deal with, I'm a Klingon warrior, I'm a Starfleet officer, but not just, I'm not a science off, you know, science or engineering. He was security. So in a way, he was Klingon warrior and Starfleet warrior. And then here comes a son that doesn't want to be a warrior. It would have, one of the missed opportunities was to show Worf having to figure out how to be a parent, mentor, and, you know, guide for this young Klingon, you know, whether it's his son or just another young kid. But, it, you know, in this case, it's even more of a responsibility because it's his son. to figure out how do you be a Klingon who's not on the warrior path. And we've seen glimpses of that throughout the series, throughout the whole franchise, that not every Klingon is a warrior. You know, there's the chefs and the lawyers and the artists and, you know, the scientists and the all. It would have been interesting if they had Alexander say, I want to be more into the sciences or more into the creative arts. And then Worf would have to, like, figure that out and, you know, help him on that path. And that could have added to the Worf character. And but it just, they just totally made him, Worf, be like a deadbeat dad of just go live with my parents, you know, go get it, get out of here. And then I wish they would have handled the Alexander character better. And then once, and because especially on TNG, I thought, okay, this is going to be interesting. And then obviously we see that he just sends him away to the parents. But then I thought, okay, that's the first time I thought, oh, missed opportunity, wasted. Oh, well, that's over. Then they bring him back on DS9, and I thought, okay, this could be interesting. Maybe they're going to try to right the wrong or, you know, fix the broken part of with this character and the storyline, and maybe that could be another friend for Jake and Nog. Because Jake and Nog, they're not in every episode. It doesn't have to be that Alexander would be in every episode, but it could be the dynamic of the human and the Ferengi become friends. Now here's this young Klingon that maybe Jake and Alexander hit it off, but Nog don't like him, or however the dynamic could go, that, you know, they start off on shaky ground, but then they all become, like, you know, three good friends. It was just, I just think that they could have handled it a lot better, and that they, because I know, like, some people say they
sounds
just
like the next Alexander hit on ABC.
There you go, Starfleet kids. But I know some people just wish Alexander was never there, like never existed, never like written in. But I just think it could have been better. They should have done, there was more, so many different paths they could have taken. And for the way that they went with it, I just think it was just weird and dropping the ball.
Yeah, like I don't think there was anything wrong with the actors or anything. I think it was the way that they were Worf responding to the situation or not responding to the situation that was the problem. I think it would have been cool to see, you know, just say Kalar doesn't get killed and they have to share custody and his issues with like wanting to be present but having to deal with his duties. I also would have liked it if it had to happen the way it did, if it had been someone other than Troy to sort of bring the two of them together. I felt like romance novel-y to me in a bad way, and
just a little.
Yeah. I think it just, yeah, it reinforced gender stereotypes and didn't really make me like any of them better.
Yeah, I mean, if they were going to have Troy do it, I think they needed to give that job to someone with a little bit more of an understanding of parenting than it seemed like any of the writers who were doing it had. Or maybe there was something else going on. I don't know. It's just, I agree with you. I think someone else
just,
would've...
I don't know, think outside the box a little more and get more creative. Like, you know, Alexander, you know, maybe he decides he really wants to get into sciences or engineering, so he's hanging out with Geordi all the time, and then Geordi's like, yo, Worf, your kid is hanging out with me, and maybe you should help encourage him or something. Like, just to think about someone that you wouldn't pick as, like, the obvious person to put there.
Yeah.
That made me think of another thing I used to think of, like, trying to have Worf figure out, because Worf was always kind of bad at certain things. And one thing it could have been that he was just like a dad, but like trying and wanting to, but just like, you know, falling down basically at it. And then you could have Sisko come in and be like, hey, Worf, here's how you be a father. And that could be a whole other dynamic between Worf and Sisko about, you know, even though, because obviously it's not that you have to know all the Klingon rituals and everything, because Alexander didn't go in that way. So that could have been another dynamic between Alexander and Jake being friends, but then having that affect Worf and Sisko's dynamic about, you know, in one way I'm your commanding officer, you're my security strategic guy. But then on the other hand, it's like Sisko mentoring Worf almost, and here's how to be a dad. And it's not going to be, because we saw Sisko go through those struggles early on when he wanted Jake home at dinner, but then Jake wanted to go off and hang with Nog, and like there's dynamics that they could have played into that in a way are just human natural stories. It didn't have to be Star Trek, but then you put it into those into the Star Trek world, and it could have t- twisted it a little bit, and so it was just sad to me that it was like wasted, lost potential. And then when they did bring Alexander back and he's joining the Klingon Defense Force and he's on the Bird of Prey and becomes like the butt of the jokes on the ship, and the I just didn't like the way they took that character. I would have rather him join the science, the Klingon Science Academy, or become a chef or become an artist. It was just, I like Alexander. I just don't like how they handled him.
I was really disappointed with, especially they made, because there's one good Alexander episode, and it's the one where he comes back from the future to kill himself.
Firstborn.
And like they established that he became a diplomat, which I think is a really cool idea, and I know different timelines, whatever, but it upset me that they decided not to go that route with Alexander. They were just like, no.
Chakotay might have died where he came from.
Maybe. It was just like, he's going to become part of the Klingon, he's going to join the Klingon army or Klingon navy, even though he doesn't know what end of a bat left to hold. And I'm just like, were they really that desperate for recruits that they would let him join? It just seems odd, and I don't know. I'll tell you one thing that I was really glad didn't happen when I first saw like Alexander show up in Deep Space Nine. I was really worried that they were gonna have him hate Dax because she's not his real mom, and I was like, I thought that was going to happen, and they were gonna do sitcom like stepmom type stories, and I was like, okay, please don't do that. And then they didn't, so I was happy for that. I'll give them that one.
Can you remind me how him and Worf leave off at the end of that episode?
They don't really. Okay, so at the end of the first one with Alexander, Alexander like basically shows that he's not a complete failure. He's just mostly a failure, like, and Worf is like, okay, well, I guess I love you anyway. Because you're still my son, and so you're gonna join the House of Martok, and so they do the little ritual, and then like we basically don't see Alexander after Worf and Dax get married, like Worf.
Yeah,
and Dax,
and that's why I was wondering, because I was just watching Time's Orphan the other day, where Worf is like trying to prove to Dax that he'd be a good parent, and there's kind of an offhanded line where he's like, I failed with Alexander, like I'm not gonna fail again, and you're like, really? Like you should care more about it than you just expressed that sentence. But
just gonna write that off as a loss.
Oh well.
Exactly. Basically like, okay, well, there's another woman who can have some kids.
It didn't work out perfectly, so I'm just going to, like, you know, scrap it and write it off. And that was the other thing. It's like, for one thing, about mishandled characters, right? And that's happened in a lot of TV shows and a lot of in Trek. So on one hand, it's like, too bad, it sucks, or, you know, that they mishandled Alexander. The other thing about that I thought is, for the writers, like, to, I think speaks, you know, shows that they're failed at storytelling, whatever, is how that, what that makes Worf look like. It's one thing to say, you know, you failed at creating interesting stories and an arc and a development of this Alexander character. That's one side of it. But it's like, do they realize or care how that made Worf turn out? It's like, it was, I just, all around, I think it was just mishandled and missed opportunities. And they didn't have to make it the Worf and Alexander, you know, father knows best time, but it's just that they could have done it a lot better than, it's just sad.
Especially since, you know, Alexander has shown now in Deep Space Nine that he wants to be in, you know, he wants to be a warrior now. He's changed his mind. He wants to do what Worf does. Like, if anything, that should make Worf more determined to help his son, because now it's not even that his son wants to do something he has no interest in. It's like, you know, this is something that Worf knows how to do. And Jara, I cannot agree more with what you said about how I failed, where he said I failed with Alexander. And it's like, dude, if you feel that way, why are you here and not trying to help your son?
I don't think it's very like Worf to just be like, yeah, I'll just give up on this.
Yeah. So, all right. I think so. That's basically all the ones I could think of for reoccurring kids. So Jara, thank you very much for coming up with this topic. I want to get everyone's final thoughts before we wrap up. So I'll go down the list as they appear on my TeamSpeak menu. David, final thoughts on children in Star Trek?
I think that all around they could have done it better. I mean, I wonder if how many of the writers that were the main writers or the regular writers, how many of them had children to know how to write a child character or write from, you know, a parent perspective. But the other thing that I noticed of, and it kind of switches around and kind of, you know, flip-flops a little bit, but I kind of remember, like, had the thought that Wesley started off wanting to be a Starfleet officer, then, you know, says he has to go be a time-traveling traveler. So he's, like, not going to follow the path of his father. Alexander didn't want to be a warrior, so that's like not wanting to follow the path of the father, and then we see that he kind of does later. But and then Nog, he wants to go to Starfleet, he doesn't follow the Ferengi path. And Jake didn't want to be in Starfleet, he wanted to be a journalist. So I kind of just thought that the closest one would probably be Wesley, but they never really did a thing where the son or the daughter was following in their parents' footsteps, like, you know, carrying the mantle or, you know, passing the torch to the next generation, that each of the kids went off and did their own thing and didn't want to continue the life or live the life of the father or the mother or the, you know. That was just something that I thought was interesting. Like, was that a conscious choice or did they just think, well, you know, it was just a weird thought. But I think for the most part, I don't know. I wouldn't give them an A or, you know, a high grade for how they handle children.
Not good work. See me after class. All right. Bob, what about you?
The question is, what do you think of children in Star Trek?
Yeah, just final thoughts.
I think they're all over the place. There was no central consensus on what part children do play in Star Trek. And they are in there. Technically, I think. Yeah, technically it's a mess, but it's, I think, an organic experience at the same time with, you know, a number of them that go through, probably minus the Borg children. I think everyone else, I think, is, you know, par for the course for what I would expect out of, you know, this continuity, this timeline, this temporal existence.
Very nice. And Jara, as our special guest, final thoughts on children in Star Trek?
Some very good points made by Bob and David. I think, yeah, overall they didn't do a super good job. I think if they had started out from a place where they started with the youngest kid in Disaster, who made his science project where he planted radishes and they grew all weird, then that would have been a more accurate starting place.
And, I believe you mean the officer in charge of radishes, just so we're clear.
Exactly. so yeah,
wish I had that job.
That it would have been nice if the writers had tapped their own experience as parents or people who even, you know, paid attention to children and tried to put them through having some more realistic issues and development.
All right, excellent. Well, thank you very much, Bob and Jara, for joining us. I hope you will come back and listen to us next week when we will be joined
Hold on. Wait, what are your thoughts, Oren?
I thought I already... I had my thoughts. I hate things. I have hate 4 times in my show notes.
That's true.
No, I mean, I kind of agree with you guys, is that I think that, you know, Jake and Nog were great. Nog especially. I think Nog is a fantastic character. He's one of the best characters in Deep Space Nine. And I think, you know, I think Naomi was overall a good addition to the crew. I just think that there were some missed opportunities. And obviously, Wesley could have been much, much better. And, you know, I hate Alexander. That's kind of, I feel like I've made my views on that pretty clear. But anyway.
So, Oren, I got a question for you.
Yeah?
How would I contact this show if I wanted to talk to these guys? Like, Oren and Grace, how do I do that?
Well, thank you, Bob, for asking. If you would like to contact us and tell us what you think about the topics that we've had and how we're wrong or how we're right, if you feel like telling us that too, you can contact us at All Things Trek. Okay. Ah, David, right in the middle of my email address.
Shut up, David. I mean, Wesley.
That would be allthingstrek@hotmail.com. And you can send us your emails and we will read them. All right, I'm going to try this part again. Maybe I will get through it without being interrupted this time. Thank you, Bob and Jara, for joining us on the show. I hope you all listen
My
to
pleasure.
Us next week.
Yes, that was good.
Next week, we will be joined once again by Data Logan, and we will discuss new and exciting topics, and I hope you will join us then. Until then, this is All Things Trek, signing off.